The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
As a small business owner, you make every dollar count. So what could you do with $10? Go to Vistaprint.com today and you'll get 500 high-quality custom business cards for only $9.99. That's less than 2 cents per card. And at Vistaprint, your satisfaction is absolutely guaranteed. So it's never been easier to turn 500 strangers into connections. Just visit Vistaprint.com and use promo code 2424 at checkout. That's Vistaprint.com, promo code 2424.
This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Hurricane Irma sets its sights on Florida.
More than 700,000 people here in Miami-Dade County are under a mandatory evacuation order.
More deaths are being reported after a strong earthquake in Mexico.
3 people were killed when a wall collapsed.
The identities of millions of Americans once again at risk.
They got access to names, social security numbers, birth dates, addresses, and in some cases, driver's license numbers.
I'm Steve Dorsey at the CBS News Washington Bureau. Hurricane Irma taking aim at Florida, some still trying to leave. More from correspondent Mark Strassman in empty Miami Beach.
More than 700,000 people here in Miami-Dade County are under a mandatory evacuation order. And you can tell that most of them have taken it seriously. Streets closed to traffic. People have studied the radar and hit the road. Irma's storm surge could put this neighborhood in high water and deep trouble.
On Miami Beach, families piled up sandbags, trying to protect their homes from the storm.
I'm scared.
Sherry Schwartz lives a half mile from the beach. She told us her neighbors are staying put, but she's not.
I would like to be in denial, but this time I'm taking heed and getting out.
On average, Miami Beach sits about 4 feet above sea level. Storm surges from Irma here could reach 3 to 6 feet.
I stay.
But there are still holdouts, like 91-year-old Holocaust survivor Joe Sachs.
I'm still like a kid that liked a challenge.
Sachs said he's uncomfortable moving to a shelter because he needs medical equipment to survive. At least 11 hospitals and 142 healthcare facilities have already closed in Florida.
We've not seen anything this ominous since Andrew. And so we're waiting for it along with the rest of the community.
Category 5 Hurricane Andrew hit Florida 25 years ago. 65 people died, and it cost the state billions of dollars in damage. Hurricane Irma is even bigger in size than Hurricane Andrew. Schwartz worries what she may come home to find after the storm.
I'm afraid that there might not be much.
It's that worrisome. Just the size of the storm?
And the power.
Despite the mandatory evacuation order, many people here will tell you they're still deciding whether to go. And for them, today is D-Day, decision day. Do I stay or do I go?
There are widespread gas shortages throughout South Florida. Irma has left a trail of destruction throughout the Caribbean. Correspondent Tony DeCopel is in San Juan, Puerto Rico.
More than half the homes here are without power, and many areas lack clean drinking water as well. But overall, Puerto Rico counts itself lucky as images of devastation roll in from islands less than a day's boat ride to the east or the west, where Hurricane Irma menaced the islands of Turks and Caicos. The howling winds and heavy rains of Irma battered the islands of Turks and Caicos. It's believed to be the first Category 5 hurricane to hit the island chain.
This is where we are, stuck in the middle of this hurricane.
Vacationers like Cynthia McCall are trapped on the islands and don't know when they'll be able to get home.
And it's Mother Nature. You have no idea what's going to happen. And then when we looked at the pictures of the devastation in Barbuda and St. Martin, it's like, my God, is that what's going to happen to us?
East of Turks and Caicos, the northern Leeward Islands received Irma's strongest punch. St. Martin was socked. The Dutch prime minister says parts of the island are without power and water, describing the damage as wide-scale destruction. Officials believe about 6,000 Americans are still trapped on the island. At least 4 people are confirmed dead and 50 injured.
The entire housing stock was damaged.
And on Barbuda, a tiny island of just over 60 square miles, nearly every building was damaged, leaving 60% of the people homeless. Rescue workers across the Caribbean are rushing to get food and fresh water to island residents, and only then can they fully assess the damage and begin the long cleanup.
Since Harvey devastated parts of Texas and Louisiana, FEMA has been in overdrive, now responding to yet another hurricane. Katie Fox is FEMA Acting Deputy Administrator for Protection and National Preparedness. Katie, thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
What's different with Irma?
Every storm is different, and Irma is a massive hurricane with some of the strongest winds on record, and so we are asking folks to take some basic steps to get prepared, that is, have 72 hours of emergency supplies and follow the guidance of your local officials.
In Texas and Louisiana, flooding was, of course, the major concern there. We understand, though, that winds with Hurricane Irma are very strong, and perhaps the storm surge could be an issue, coastal erosion. What is FEMA concerned about?
We're concerned about all of it, to be perfectly honest with you. I mean, this storm has monster winds. The storm surge numbers that they're talking about are huge. And then inland flooding and rainfall is always a problem and often kills people in storms like this. So really all of it is worrisome.
How big of an undertaking, though, are the evacuations and response going on in especially South Florida?
They're a massive undertaking. Anytime you try to evacuate the numbers of folks who live in South Florida, it is a massive undertaking. That's why it's really important to listen to the guidance of your local officials. They do things in a phased way, so that is important.
The president has said FEMA officials haven't gotten a night of sleep, at least since Harvey. Is FEMA stretched thin?
FEMA is working across the board to make sure that we are taking care of the people in Texas, the survivors of Harvey, but also leading forward. We've got folks on the ground in the U.S. Virgin Islands, in Puerto Rico, in Florida, and really all along the eastern seaboard. I mean, this is what we prepare for. This is what we train for.
Does FEMA have enough money to last through the recovery in Irma?
The administration is working closely with Congress to make sure that we have the resources that we need, and that is not at all standing in the way of life safety or life-sustaining issues.
FEMA Acting Deputy Administrator for Protection and National Preparedness, Katie Fox. Stay safe, Katie.
Thank you. You too.
Meanwhile, as the cleanup continues from Harvey in Houston, one group is bringing some joy to children affected by the storm.
Amidst the pain and suffering of the past week, there was a brief moment of joy here in Houston.
I am Ariel from The Little Mermaid.
I'm Elena of Avalor.
Outside the city's convention center, which has served as the main evacuation location, suddenly appeared three women from the world of make-believe.
Do you know my friends Ariel and Snow White?
Hello.
They work for a local company called Fairy Tale Headquarters. Dozens of children were transfixed. They rushed over to see. This young girl wanted to know where Belle from Beauty and the Beast was.
Have you seen Belle?
She
couldn't come out with us today.
Yeah. It was moving. This woman plays Snow White.
It's really a blessing that we could give our time and we could bring some light to their time of need and allow them to escape maybe for a moment about what's going on.
This mother who brought her son was thankful.
It allows them for that little bit of joy to return, even though they may have lost everything, and they don't know that they've lost everything.
Steve Futterman, CBS News, Houston.
Still to come, Democrats push for immigration reform after the president's decision to wind down DACA.
We've seen many pushes for immigration reform before, and they have all come up short.
That's next on the Weekend Roundup. On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. The clock is now running for Congress to respond to the children of undocumented immigrants in the U.S. worried they'll be deported.
Late Tuesday, President Trump publicly defended his decision to end DACA before passing the buck to Congress.
I have a love for these people, and hopefully now Congress will be able to help them.
The Obama-era program granted deportation protections to an estimated 800,000 people brought illegally to the U.S. as children. Earlier in the day, Attorney General Jeff Sessions formally announced plans to wind it down, citing constitutional concerns.
If we are to further our goal of strengthening the constitutional order and the rule of law in America, the Department of Justice cannot defend this overreach.
The president is giving lawmakers 6 months to possibly save DACA, but is urging them to tie it to overall immigration reform. Republican House Speaker Paul Ryan expressed hope, not certainty, that Congress will find consensus so that those who have done nothing wrong can still contribute as a valued part of this great country. Democrat Dick Durbin and Republican Lindsey Graham called on colleagues to pass the DREAM Act. The measure would allow immigrant students to apply for legal status and potentially gain citizenship if they go to college or serve in the military.
They have no other country other than America. They're no more connected to their home country than I am to Scotland, where my grandfather came from.
In a statement posted on Facebook, President Obama added his voice to the debate, calling President Trump's decision self-defeating and cruel. Mola Lenghi, CBS News, the White House.
Correspondent Bill Rakoff talked about DACA and the president's agenda with columnist Niall Stanage from The Hill newspaper.
One of the questions that I have right off the bat, the significance of the statement coming from Attorney General Sessions rather than the president.
Well, I think one of the elements in that is the prospect that this could be a politically perilous move by the president. DACA is fairly popular with the electorate at large. And I think Attorney General Sessions coming out and making that announcement was a way to shield or try to shield the president to some extent from the downside politically of this. Whether it will work or not is an entirely different question.
There's been some narrative that's tried to be built about the president kind of wrestling with this decision, and that this was not a cut and dried thing. But again, as you mentioned, he campaigned on it. So who's that argument going toward, and is anybody there buying it?
The argument that he's wrestling with it emanates from the fact that after he was elected president, he made a number of comments that were more conciliatory toward the so-called Dreamers than the comments he had made on the campaign trail. I do think DACA has a specificity to it beyond the general immigration debate, simply because these are people who were brought to the United States as minors. Many of them do not know any other home other than the United States. And there was some evidence that President Trump was grappling with the human side of that question and continues to do so even as he proposes to end the program.
This goes to Congress now, which is what many people have said it should have been in the first place. Congress has had a couple of opportunities to address this. They've not been able to do anything now. Overwhelming sentiment on the Democrats against ending the program, but Republicans, too, notably the leadership. The Speaker is out on record saying this is the wrong way to go. Corporations are out there saying it's the wrong way to go. What are the tea leaves saying on Capitol Hill regarding the appetite to do this?
Immigration has been a very, very politically difficult subject for Republicans. You're quite right that Speaker Ryan and others have come out against ending DACA, but that is a very different thing from passing legislation to actually replace it. It is possible that legislation will be passed. There are certainly Republicans who fear political damage if DACA simply ends, and they are the party that is seen as responsible for ending it. But we've seen many pushes for immigration reform before, and they have all come up short.
You write about Trump's critical fall with a list of things that he's going to have to. And I stopped writing at about 7 or 8 of them. Tax reform, we kind of touched on, spending, health care, North Korea. But now, I mean, not only does Harvey play into this, but now we're looking at the prospect of Irma coming in here. Talk for a minute about how a storm and maybe even a 1-2 punch like Harvey and Irma can derail an agenda for the president.
It can derail it in a couple of ways. One is obviously that there is political pressure almost instantaneously to deliver funds to the people who have been affected. Very few people would quibble with that. But the other issue is one in which there's only a certain amount of political oxygen in the room. On a practical level, there's only a certain number of legislative days to accomplish anything. And so when a storm, as you put it, Billy, a 1-2 punch is a possibility, that can really eat into the time available, and it can refocus everyone's political energy toward those kind of issues rather than whatever had been planned.
Is it understating to say that if something happens like a Harvey Irma sequence, that it could be as significant as a military action was, say, to previous administrations? And I think about Iraq, among other things.
It can be if it goes wrong. I mean, clearly in President George W. Bush's case, the response to Hurricane Katrina became a very, very heavy political millstone around his neck. It crystallized, I think, some criticisms of President Bush that had been more broadly in the ether before that. President Trump has so far, I think, earned sort of modestly warm reviews for his response to Hurricane Harvey. We'll see how that plays out in the weeks and months ahead. But certainly there is always the potential for something of that scale to really scramble the political calculus.
And lastly, you mentioned political oxygen, that is, and some of it of his own making, others out of his control, such as the weather, such as the situation in North Korea, but certainly DACA, tax reform, the threat to possibly shut down the government, which may not be as real a thing at the moment, but and of course the Russia investigation. Have you seen, in your mind, a president with this much on his plate at one time? Or is it fair to compare with previous administrations?
I think the difference in President Trump's case is that some of these things, as you point out, are of his own making. When President Obama was first inaugurated, he was obviously grappling with a once-in-a-generation financial crisis. The nation was still at war in two separate conflicts, so he faced an enormous amount. But in President Trump's case right now, we have these issues that are sometimes of his own making, plus the legislative calendar creates its own pressures, and that's what makes this different.
Niall Stanage is one of the senior writers at The Hill. He authors The Memo at TheHill.com. You can check that out, Life Inside the White House, and we appreciate your time today.
Thanks, Bill.
I'm Bill Rakoff, CBS News.
Up next, the Navy under the microscope in Congress after two deadly ship collisions.
I think we can all agree that our nation failed these 17 sailors.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
In business, risks and rewards come with every decision, like moving to the cloud with Office 365. While its benefits include anywhere access and lower costs, cyber threats and user errors can quickly wipe out data and the money you save. Barracuda Essentials for Office 365 provide an added layer of security and functionality for threat protection, email migration, data recovery, and quality of service. Move securely to Office 365. Visit barracuda.com/essentials to learn more.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. President Trump told reporters Thursday he's open to discussing with Congress a way to eliminate the country's borrowing limit, known as the debt ceiling.
You know, it could be discussed. For many years, people have been talking about getting rid of debt ceiling altogether, and there are a lot of good reasons to do that.
Mr. Trump suggested voting to raise the debt ceiling in Congress creates a logjam for other legislation. It comes as members of his own party are still reeling over his deal with Democrats to increase the debt ceiling for 3 months and extend government funding in a bill tied to Hurricane Harvey relief that passed Friday.
President Trump pitched his tax reform plan to a crowd in North Dakota Wednesday after stunning Republicans and striking a deal with Democrats over the debt ceiling in a White House meeting earlier in the day.
I had a great bipartisan meeting with Democrat and Republican leaders in Congress, and I'm committed to working with both parties to deliver for our wonderful, wonderful citizens. It's about time.
In an effort to expedite money for Harvey relief, the president embraced Senators Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi's idea of a three-month spending and debt ceiling compromise.
The bottom line is the president listened to the arguments. We think we made a very reasonable and strong argument. And to his credit, he went with the better argument.
But while Mr. Trump sold it as an opportunity for bipartisanship, collaboration with the other side blindsided GOP congressional leaders.
The president can speak for himself, but his feeling was that we needed to come together to not create a picture of divisiveness at a time of genuine national crisis.
Now, Congress has until December 15th to agree on a longer-term deal to keep the government funded. Seth Lemon for CBS News, Washington.
The president also warned North Korea Thursday about its nuclear weapons program after it apparently tested an H-bomb underground.
Only days after a massive underground bomb blast, there are signs that North Korea may be preparing a new missile launch. South Korea has responded with another show of force. This time, its Navy conducting live fire drills, vowing it could bury its northern neighbor at sea. But North Korea's weapons program continues to accelerate. Kim Jong-un has launched 18 missiles this year.
There is this cartoon character stereotype of Kim Jong-un. Is he a madman?
No, he is not a madman.
Andrei Lankov is a professor at Kukmin University in Seoul. He's followed Kim Jong-un since he took over at age 27 in 2011. He consolidated his power by killing his uncle and reportedly having his elder half-brother assassinated in a Malaysian airport.
He is ruthless and homicidal exactly because he is rational. It's not a job for somebody who is shy of killing people.
Lankov says Kim Jong-un wants nuclear weapons so his regime can't be overthrown by the U.S. with help from South Korea. North Korean weapons program expert Daniel Pinkston.
It's very clear what they want. It's to achieve the final victory, which means unifying Korea on their terms. Secondly, it means expelling the United States from the region, and they continue to develop strategies every day to achieve those goals.
None of the experts we've talked to believe that North Korea would make a preemptive strike on the U.S. or one of its allies. But the big question is, what does the U.S. now do if North Korea keeps launching missiles over Japan? Ben Tracy, CBS News, Seoul.
We learned more about the two deadly Navy ship collisions this year Thursday during a hearing in Congress.
Congressman Rob Whitman heads a subcommittee on sea power.
I think we can all agree that our nation failed these 17 sailors.
The General Accounting Office's John Pendleton said part of the problem is not enough ships.
I don't know what specifically caused the accidents, but I do know the Navy is caught between an unrelenting operational demand and a limited supply of ships.
So much so, some ships aren't being certified. Admiral Bill Moran, Vice Chief of Naval Operations.
Which ought to give us all pause for just how hard we're driving the crews in 7th Fleet.
Cammie McCormick, CBS News, The Pentagon.
Hillary Clinton is defending herself and attacking her own party in her upcoming book. More from correspondent Nancy Cordes.
In a sometimes biting new book first obtained by CNN, Clinton argues she was done in part by an unhealthy fixation on her marriage, her health, and her emails. What makes me such a lightning rod for fury? I'm really asking. I'm at a loss, she writes. I think it's partly because I'm a woman. Clinton admits it was bad optics to give highly paid speeches in the run-up to the race. And she admits she and her team misread the mood of the country. I was running a traditional presidential campaign with carefully thought-out policies and painstakingly built coalitions, while Trump was running a reality TV show that expertly and relentlessly stoked Americans' anger and resentment.
She is so dependent on big money interests.
Primary opponent Bernie Sanders, she writes, had to resort to innuendo and impugning my character because the two agreed on so much, a move she says did her lasting damage.
This is a phony attack.
And she clearly resents the second-guessing of her message by party leaders like Vice President Joe Biden. I find this fairly remarkable, considering that Joe himself campaigned for me all over the Midwest and talked plenty about the middle class.
Clinton reveals that she was so confident of a win on election night that she was actually napping as the results began to roll in. She says conceding to Mr. Trump later was shocking because it was so, quote, weirdly ordinary, like calling a neighbor to say you can't make it to his barbecue. Nancy Cordes, CBS News, Washington.
As the Southeast copes with Irma, the West Coast is struggling with wildfires. More from CBS News correspondent Jamie Yukas.
As the fire came racing toward Craig Bolinson's childhood home, he had seconds to carry his father out in a wheelchair.
It was a freight train, and it sounded like that, too.
It was one of four homes destroyed in a fire in the hills surrounding Los Angeles.
I think the fire started to generate its own wind, and it just leaned forward and started charging down the hill faster than I could have run in front of it.
Sweltering 100-degree heat and late afternoon winds created a fast-moving fire that sent Burbank homeowners into a panic to get out with whatever they could carry. More than 1,000 firefighters battled flames as high as 50 feet, burning close to homes and right up to the edge of the freeway that connects Los Angeles to Pasadena. Los Angeles Fire Chief Ralph Terraza.
Fire operations are not over. There's still a lot of work to be done.
Linda and Sam Sherdell lost everything in their Sunland home.
The next step is we don't know. I mean, we're just kind of living day by day right now.
That used to be the Sherdell stove. Now all that's left of the home is rubble and ash. We learned a short time ago that the California National Guard has called in an additional 350 members to fight fires across the state. Jamie Yukis, CBS News, Sunland, California.
Coming up on the Weekend Roundup, digging through the rubble left behind from a deadly earthquake in Mexico. Follow us on Twitter. We've got headlines at CBS News Radio, and I'm tweeting at Steve_Dorsey on the CBS News Weekend Roundup. On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. Parts of southern Mexico along the Pacific coast were rocked by a major earthquake late Thursday.
There are confirmed reports of casualties in two Mexican states. In the colonial mountain town San Cristobal de las Casas, three people were killed when a wall collapsed. Images posted on social media of that town show some of the old stucco houses crumbling. Dozens of aftershocks have been felt, and Mexico's president told his country experts predict a strong aftershock capable of causing damage is still possible. Adrian Bard, CBS News, Mexico City.
The United Nations says more than 150,000 Rohingya minority Muslims have fled into Bangladesh from Myanmar over the last 2 weeks. It comes as Myanmar's army responded to attacks from Rohingya militants. The BBC's Jonathan Head is one of a few journalists to visit the western state of Rakhine.
The government had taken us well south of Mongdor to one of the places attacked by Rohingya militants 2 weeks ago. We passed village after village which had been abandoned or burnt. No Muslims remained, so far as we could see. Yet the Rakhine Buddhists we spoke to still live in fear of them. "We hate them," one man told me. "They're terrorists. We can never live with them again." The town of Ale Tanjore has been razed to the ground. The police told us it was the militants who did it when they attacked. But many of the fires were still smouldering 2 weeks later in the monsoon rainy season and in a town that appeared to have only police units in it. In the distance, we heard automatic gunfire. The fighting does not appear to be over in Rakhine State. But we also saw huge plumes of smoke, at least four, over the rice fields, almost certainly villages being torched. With much of the Rohingya population displaced and the militants under constant pressure from the army and police, who is doing the burning? We found out in an unscripted part of our government-controlled tour when we were able to stop by an abandoned Muslim village which had only just been set alight. The flames were just starting to lick the palm thatch walls of the houses. As we walked in, men armed with swords and machetes and who identified themselves as Rakhine Buddhists walked out. They were the only ones there. In a matter of minutes, most of the village was little more than charred, smoking ruins. Empty jugs, smelling of petrol, had been left in the paths, along with scattered clothing and toys. We saw people wheeling away looted items on trolleys through the rice fields. This area has a substantial police barracks close by. The government is right that there has been plenty of violence from the Muslim side, but it stretches credulity to blame the systematic destruction of Muslim villages on them.
A major contributor to the world of high fashion has died.
He was a businessman, a patron of the arts, and longtime partner of designer Yves Saint Laurent, whom he helped to set up in business. Pierre Berger was also a leading player in the fight against AIDS that killed so many of their friends. Tributes have been pouring in from across the social and political spectrum, praising his courage, dedication to the arts, and his outspoken defense of equal rights for all. Berger was 86 and had been ill for some time. Elaine Cobb, CBS News, Paris.
Back home, Education Secretary Betsy DeVos announced Thursday she'll roll back Obama-era policies on how colleges should handle allegations of sexual assault on campus. Correspondent Jen Crawford spoke with her.
The truth is that the system established by the prior administration has failed too many students.
Education Secretary Betsy DeVos said her department would soon begin the process of undoing the Obama-era guidelines.
There must be a better way forward. Every survivor of sexual misconduct must be taken seriously. Every student accused of sexual misconduct must know that guilt is not predetermined.
Betsy DeVos has got to go!
Protesters chanting outside said the 2011 guidelines protected victims of college sexual assault. They lowered the standard of proof for sexual assault cases and often denied the accused a right to cross-examine witnesses or hear evidence against them. Opponents say they have created another class of victims, innocent students wrongly punished. DeVos spoke to CBS News after her speech.
So you'll be rescinding those guidelines
that's the near future? Sometime in the near future. And in the interim period during the rulemaking process, we will come alongside institutions to ensure that they are meeting their obligations under Title IX.
But you're not going to level any kind of enforcement actions against universities that don't follow the Obama guidelines as of today?
The intention is to withdraw that letter, but the facts remain that schools need to take their Title IX obligations seriously.
DeVos will now solicit public comment in developing new rules. She mentioned a series of proposals by Harvard Law School professors who've been highly critical of the Obama guidelines as one possible way to restore fairness and due process. Jan Crawford, CBS News, Washington.
Steve Bannon calls himself a street fighter, declaring war on the Republican establishment. He left the White House as chief strategist last month. For the premiere of the 50th season of 60 Minutes, Charlie Rose interviewed Bannon.
The Republican establishment is trying to nullify the 2016 election. That's a brutal fact we have to face.
The Republican establishment.
The Republican establishment.
Wants to nullify the 2016 election.
Trying to nullify the 2016 election. Right. Absolutely.
Who?
I think Mitch McConnell and to a degree Paul Ryan. They do not want Donald Trump's populist, economic, nationalist agenda to be implemented. It's very obvious. It's obvious as night follows day.
Give me a story that illustrates that.
Well, Mitch McConnell, when we first met him, I mean, he said, I think, in one of the first meetings in Trump Tower with the president, as we're wrapping up, he basically says, I don't want to hear any more of this drain the swamp talk. Flat out. He goes, a guy up on Capitol Hill can't buy a Coke unless it's got to be reported. He says, I can't hire any smart people because everybody's all over them for reporting requirements and the pay, et cetera, in the scrutiny. You know, you got to back off that. The drain the swamp thing was Mitch McConnell was day one. Did not want to go there, wanted us to back off.
You are attacking on many fronts people who you need to help you to get things done.
They're not going to help you unless they're put on notice. They're going to be held accountable if they do not support the President of the United States. Right now, there's no accountability. They do not support the president's program. It's an open secret on Capitol Hill. Everybody in the city knows it.
And so, therefore, now that you're out of the White House, you go into war with them.
Absolutely.
A California board recommends that one of Charles Manson's followers be granted parole. KNX Radio's Brian Ping reports.
For the second time in as many years, a state corrections board has recommended Leslie Van Houten's release from prison. She was 19 when she repeatedly stabbed Rosemary LaBianca. Van Houten's attorney Rich Pfeiffer tells KNX Governor Brown's decision last year to deny parole was based on testimony that has since been disqualified.
There's no question she's going to get parole. The only question is when.
Van Houten supporters have long argued that she's been a model citizen during her time in prison. If the governor grants parole, she would be the first of the Manson murderers to go free. Brian Ping, CBS News, Los Angeles.
Coming up, the identities of millions of Americans at risk.
With a massive trove of data, the very type of data that identity thieves and scammers need to do their dirty work.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
Ransomware is software that can infiltrate your business through email, enabling cyber criminals to hijack sensitive information as ransom for your own data's release. Leveraging Barracuda email security with advanced threat detection can stop a ransomware attack in its tracks. As an added measure, Barracuda Backup allows you to recover your data without having to surrender to extortion. Crime doesn't pay when you protect your business data with Barracuda. Go to Barracuda.com/ransomware to learn more.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, I'm Steve Dorsey. The credit monitoring company Equifax is investigating a massive security breach affecting 143 million Americans. Let's talk with CBS News technology consultant Larry Maggott about this. Larry, what happened?
Well, there was a breach that occurred between May and July, and they got access to names, social security numbers, birth dates, addresses, and in some cases, driver's license numbers, as well as credit card numbers, the very type of data that identity thieves and scammers need to do their dirty work.
Equifax discovered this data theft July 29th, we hear, but waited until Thursday to notify its customers. Larry, how do you think that affects things?
Well, I think that's a long time. Now, there is a certain time when a company might wait if they know they have a vulnerability and they want to fix the vulnerability so they don't alert other hackers to get in. It seems like that was a long time. So I think that that's going to be looked at. And it's probably one of the features that'll come up, or one of the issues that'll come up in the class action suit that's already been launched against Equifax.
And there's concerns this stolen data, in the meantime, could have been sold, what, on the dark web?
Yeah, it could be posted on the dark web, and it could be used right away, or it could be used days, weeks, months, or even years from now, because this kind of data hangs around. So it's kind of a long-term threat for people, and one of the reasons why you should constantly be monitoring your credit, constantly looking at your credit card, not constantly, but frequently looking at your credit card transactions to make sure that you're not a victim of identity theft or anybody doing things in your name.
But the irony of that is you should be doing that, and the people that were using Equifax were doing that, and now they're subject to this data breach.
Well, actually, everybody is subject to the data breach, even if you never did anything with Equifax. I don't have a business relationship with Equifax, but they have a business relationship with me because they access my data. They get it from lenders and other businesses. In some ways, we're more their product than their customers. But you're right that you can go onto their website. You can either pay them money to monitor your credit, or now you can get it for free because of this breach. They've set up a website where they're offering their credit monitoring service for a year for free. That's the least they could do. But I recommend people do that, I guess, but also go to the Federal Trade Commission sanctioned site where you can get access to all of your credit reports annually for free.
This has already affected the stock price of Equifax. Mm-hmm. This is the latest, of course, as you know, in a string of cyber attacks stealing data. Yahoo was another big high-profile target. How serious of a threat is this to online companies and Silicon Valley?
Well, so Yahoo was bigger in terms of numbers, much bigger, but this is much bigger in terms of the consequences, the type of information that was pilfered. And I think it's a huge threat to the online world because people are no longer feeling secure with the information that they're putting online, or in this case, that others are putting out there about them. But at the end of the day, I don't think any of us are going to go back to the days of typewriters and adding machines and handwritten notes. I think we're all going to continue to use online technology. We're just going to have to take risks and do the best we can and hope that big companies and institutions are doing all they can to double down to protect our data.
CBS News technology consultant Larry Magid. Thanks, Larry.
My pleasure.
One of the most influential feminist writers of the 20th century, Kate Millett, has died. She was 82. She helped inject sexual politics into the mainstream. The BBC's David Silitu has more.
It was 47 years ago this week that Time magazine tackled a new political movement, Women's Lib. And the face they chose for the front cover was Kate Millett. Her book, Sexual Politics, was one of the intellectual cornerstones of a new wave of feminism. She was declared by Time to be the Mao Zedong of women's liberation. It was unexpected fame for this rather shy, academic 34-year-old sculptor living in New York. The book had started out as her university thesis. What made it so inspirational was that this was about more than just discrimination. It challenged everything: attitudes to appearance, sex, marriage, art, and literature.
If it were just a matter of changing discrimination or something, we could write up a whole series of laws and paste them all over, and that'd be it. But with women, just as with any oppressed group, the thing gets interiorized, and it, you know, it rots our souls, too.
She was something of a reluctant figurehead, and when she revealed she was a lesbian, she spoke about the tensions it created in the women's movement, with many uncomfortable with any link with gay liberation. She was primarily an artist with her own artist's colony rather than a political leader. But 50 years on, many of those once radical ideas about domestic violence, education, gender roles, and same-sex relationships are now commonplace.
Lego has a new challenge, rebuilding itself in the 21st century.
What are we going to build here, fellas?
So this specific model is the
Empire State Building.
13-year-old David Markfording, flanked by his 9-year-old brother Daniel and their 9-year-old pal Michael Elliott, are Lego fanatics.
Yeah. I have a huge Lego bin in my house.
Huge Lego bin.
Huge.
It's pretty simple. See it in your mind. Build it with your hands.
If you know what pieces to use, how to use them, and where to put them.
If you know those things, then you're good to go with whatever you can imagine.
Yeah.
Lego.
It's been that way since the Danish company began exporting Lego here in 1961.
A whole new world to build.
But with revenue down this year and profits too, the company is running into some digital headwinds.
Do you guys play video games?
Oh, yeah, I do a lot.
Parents report more than 60% of kids 12 and under now use touchscreens in their play. Less than 50% use blocks.
Well, I like to say the toy industry is a 19th century industry struggling like hell to get into the 21st century.
Toy industry consultant Richard Gottlieb says with its creative marketing, Lego is a model for old school toy makers struggling to deal with the digital age.
I am so pumped up!
So don't write any obituaries for Lego.
Oh, never. They'll be playing with it in the 27th century.
And Lego has an important advantage.
Michael, what do you want to be when you grow up?
Either an architect or a engineer.
Does this help you with that?
Yes.
After all, they are building blocks for the future. Jim Axelrod, CBS News, New York.
Finally this weekend, robo-dogs doing dirty work.
A Kyushu-based company has created a small robotic dog that can detect and measure odor levels, hold a sock or other material up to its sensor-equipped nose, and if the odor is mild, the robo-dog will wag its tail. But if the dog gets wind of a really stinky sock, it will keel over and faint. The inventors say their next-generation robo-dog will automatically spray air freshener whenever it gets a whiff of something unpleasant. Lucy Kraft, CBS News, Tokyo.
That does it for the weekend roundup. Thanks for listening. We want to get your feedback. Send us your story ideas, chain letters, love letters, whatever, to weekendroundup at cbsnews.com. The show's always online on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, and now Spotify. The Weekend Roundup is produced at the CBS News Washington Bureau. Lou Walker is the technical supervisor. Dory Valerio is the production assistant in New York. Have a great week. I'm Steve Dorsey, CBS News.